Good morning. Welcome to the K-12 Education Finance Committee. The first bill up on the in committee today is House File 2099, Representative Nornes.
Morning, thank you.
Good morning.
Members, Madam Chair. House File 2099 is a bill that was brought to me by the School Board Association, and it represents, I guess, the first time that we've attempted to change the present law for, I mean, it's the first time in 12 years that we've addressed this particular issue. What it does, it increases to $8,000 per fiscal year the maximum amount of an employment contract between a school board member and a school district. The current limit is $5,000, and this bill increases that to $8,000. We have a testifier here from the School Board Association to explain further. Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. This statute actually governs how much a board member can work in the district on which they're a board member. These would be your substitute bus drivers, substitute paraprofessionals, special ed aides, library aides, and about 12 years ago we put in a limit of $5,000. That has not been changed in a long time. And at our delegate assembly process in December, Westbrook Walnut Grove came forward, the Buffalo School District came forward, the Renville County West School Board came forward and asked us to look at increasing that number, that we were losing school board members and people who are interested in running for the school board because they had very part-time employment at the district which they would run for the board in. In our rural areas, especially members, this is a hugely important issue because we, you know, it's the choice is going to be, do you really want to put a licensed teacher, a retired teacher in that substitute classroom where the secretary is going to have to run it? And the drawback, at least in this category, is because they're a school board member, they're only allowed to make $5,000 a year. So I will pause and answer any questions.
Are there any questions? And I'm assuming that if there are any contract negotiations affecting that particular school board member, that they would recuse themselves?
Madam Chairman, actually, I forgot to mention, too, that the school majority vote of the school board on which they serve has to allow the appointment to take place. So there is scrutiny over all those things as it goes forward. And actually, the board has to vote on whether to allow the appointment to occur.
And Ms. Schwab, but you didn't answer my question. Is it general practice that someone that isn't under the employment of the school district and there's a contract negotiations going on that might affect their employment, do they generally recuse themselves from voting on that matter?
Madam Chairman, I believe they don't participate in it, but they may take the final vote on the contract issue. So they wouldn't be a party to what would be in that, but they would vote up or down at the time it comes to a vote for the board.
All right. Are there any other questions? If not, where is this going to the general register?
Well, I was going to ask that question. I don't know if this would be something you'd want in your omnibus bill, or it can go to the general register.
Oh, we could just put it in here in the omnibus bill if you want. Big bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd just like to ask Ms. Schwab a follow-up to your questioning, because that does sound rather odd to me that a board member would not participate in the discussion and yet have a final vote. So their line of thinking, their rationale, everything about representation, which is what an elected board member should be about, never gets aired, all right? And instead they just take a final vote. I don't quite get that process.
Ms. Schwab?
Madam Chairman, Representative Biskins, basically, board members, because there are usually 6 to 7 bargaining units in a school district, often break down into different groups to negotiate with those subgroups. So I'm guessing, because I really actually, other than knowing a couple of these folks, don't have statewide information on it. But my assumption is if they were you know, working as a substitute teacher, they probably would say, you know, why don't you work with the lunchroom ladies? More of a common sense approach. The board, as they come to a vote, though, board members take their elected role very seriously and weigh in the end result. But I think the fine-tuning of that, you know, there's usually two board members on each negotiations unit. And as they go back and forth, they just choose another one. Board members are very sensitive to how the public views this. And usually people just care about kids and want to do the right thing, help out with the school. And part of it is being a board member. The other part is having some kind of training or interest in education, such as a bus driver or special ed aide, library aides.
Schwab, Mr. Meeks is behind you, and he may want to share maybe if what he knows about the process in the school districts.
Madam Chair, Bob Meeks with School Board Association. I'm sorry I didn't get all the question. Is it why board members do not participate in the debate but do vote? Was that the question, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. It was, and maybe it was a confusion on the first answer, because the second answer I heard Ms. Schwab give is that it's not they don't participate in the debate when it comes to final vote. It's that they're not participating in the sub-negotiations discussions, which would make sense to me. But I guess, Mr. Meeks, my question is, do they participate in the debate prior to the vote on a contract?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Biskins, Ms. Schwab is correct. The board member will not participate in a debate. Now, that does not mean the board member will not provide information about being the volleyball coach when no one on the staff wants to be the volleyball coach and we want to have a volleyball team. So that's a hiring process. It takes a majority vote. If you remember, a couple of years ago, it might have been the chair carried the bill for us, but at one time it took a unanimous vote, and one person could blackball that person from anything, and we changed that. So even if the person did abstain, under the AG's opinion, an abstention goes with the majority. So if they, many will vote, many will abstain. It's really doesn't make any difference because it's going to be counted that way anyway. But as far as would you and I, as a board, you're one board member and I'm another, would we get in a debate whether or not I should be the volleyball coach? No. I would lay out my interest in being a volleyball coach. You and other members of the board may debate whether or not you want me as a volleyball coach. But what we're trying to do is clarify that given time, this figure has not changed. And we're losing some very good board members because they're taking positions no one else wants, or we can't get somebody to fill that position.
Mr. Meeks, though, I would think in that instance, though, I would hope that the volleyball coach would recuse themselves from voting when at time, you know, even though there was a discussion. I would hate to think that in the public's eye that that person would then be voting on his position to be hired.
Madam Chair, most of them do, but at the same time, some people say, well, you're ducking the issue. You should be on the record. Well, of course I'm on the record because I asked for the job.
Right.
It's kind of darned if you do and darned if you don't in some districts.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions? All right. Oh, I'm sorry. We do need to move the bill. House File 2099. I will move it to be before our committee for consideration on the K-12 finance bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The bill is adopted. Or it's not adopted. I'm sorry. It's held over. We voted.
Is that the bill?
The bill's approved. The bill is adopted. You know, I have to explain to members, I've been chairing another committee that does vote occasionally, and I just got into a role here.
Madam Chair, were you indicating that your favor would be disposed to the previous bill?
I guess so. All right. House File 1831 is the next bill up. Oh. I need some water. Thank you. Welcome, Representative Demmert. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 1831 for possible inclusion in the Education Finance, K-12 Education Omnibus Bill.
All right. Now, this bill has been before Education Policy, and it is before us for possible inclusion. Do you have any witnesses, or you want to just kind of summarize your bill? Because I think most of us have heard.
Well, Madam Chair, if we could, the people who spoke in policy were, Mr. Kite from the Minnesota Association of Secondary Administrators.
Mm-hmm. If you want your witnesses.
Roger Amundson, also from the Principals Association, and right. I believe Jim Bartholomew may have spoken. And we can have them speak if you'd like, Madam Chair, or they can just answer questions if others who didn't get a chance to hear them, whichever you choose.
However you want to do it, if you want to just briefly summarize your bill, have a couple of people testify, why don't you just do a brief summary and have a couple of testifiers and we'll take questions.
Very good, Madam Chair. Again, House File 1831 is a governor's initiative, and basically what it does is it says that school boards are not allowed to negotiate away the right of a superintendent to assign teachers. I think the impetus for the bill primarily is about assigning teachers in difficult situations. If there was some sort of a seniority system in place that whenever there was a retirement or somebody leaves a district, that there gets to be kind of a system where people can say, I want that spot, and it's based on seniority, you ultimately have the most senior teachers in a school district leaving maybe difficult situations where maybe their skills are more needed. And the ultimate effect of that is the positions that get left open for brand new teachers coming in oftentimes are the most difficult situations for teachers to teach in, which I think lends itself to maybe some of the teacher burnout that we talk about, maybe some of the turnover we get in teachers' first 3 years of teaching. The other piece that comes to play is as we look for schools and accountability to schools, that oftentimes goes to the superintendent and the administration in terms of how the school is working with the staff and assigning staff for the best for kids. And I think taking that authority from a superintendent, as a board may do in negotiations, would basically tie that superintendent's hands behind his back in some situations and not be able to basically be accountable in the way they're supposed to be. So I guess with that, Madam Chair, that summarizes very quickly what the bill is and some of the reasons for it. And with that, I'd ask Mr. Kite to say a few words.
Welcome, Mr. Kite.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Charlie Kite, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, here to speak in favor of this bill. I'll just keep my comments very brief. First of all, let me begin by saying that the comments I'm making about this bill are not anti or negative towards teachers, and we have a deep-rooted respect for the teachers that we have in our school systems. Also, this bill affects really a limited number of school districts. There's some school districts in the metropolitan area that have language in their contracts that was entered into a number of years ago that significantly limits the right of assignment. And there's some pockets in outstate Minnesota in a few places. So we're not talking about all school districts. In fact, in the great majority of school districts in Minnesota, there is the right of assignment of staff, and that works really quite well. With that said, the right of assignment is the assignment of staff to specific school buildings, has to do with the assignment of staff to specific licensure areas within that teacher's license, and it has to do with the right of assignment to specific kinds and levels of classes within their licensure area. With more choice and more mobility going on, the arena for in terms of the need to be able to assign staff has simply changed in the last number of years. And we, as schools, we need to be more nimble in being able to move staff to the right areas where there are concentrations of students or lack of students. And it's important that we be able to have teachers that are mixed well in terms of their skills and their ages, etc., so that we get the right mix of teachers working with students. So we need more ability to do this. some of the systems that were negotiated and put in place a number of years ago that require a posting and then a seniority-based system of assignment of teachers are not working well anymore, in our opinion. I also want to share one last comment. One of the problems we also run into in school systems where there is a kind of a bumping rights seniority-based system is in those systems that the process of those, the bumping from job to job to job, significantly slows down the district's ability to hire teachers. In the meantime, those school districts that don't have these kinds of clauses in their contract are able to go out and hire their teachers first. So the schools that are slowed down in their hiring processes always are forced to hire the teachers on the second and third round of hiring as opposed to getting the first round of the folks that you might want to hire. So with that, MASA does support this legislation, and we'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Mr. Aronson, would you like to come up?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Roger Aronson. I'm here to testify in support of 1831, and as the Chair appropriately pointed out, we did talk about this in the full committee as well. But the reason I want to come back and restate some of that testimony is that several of our principal groups, in particular the Minneapolis principal groups, strongly support this initiative. We have several labor contracts out there with teachers that have provisions in them that significantly limit the ability of school districts to assign these teachers where we think they would be best assigned. Currently, it is not possible to negotiate these provisions out of the collective bargaining agreements. They've been in place in these collective bargaining agreements for years, negotiated by members of school boards who are no longer even on these boards. The only way we can get these changed is if you pass 1831. We actually think this is a very appropriate exercise of legislative power in this very limited circumstance to say we're going to hold superintendents and principals accountable for assigning teachers into particular sites. What happens in Minneapolis in particular is the teachers have rights into particular buildings. We have some sites that are more difficult than others. We have had experiences where we end up with nothing but probationary teachers in those sites. That's not how we think business should be done. It's not best for the kids. It's not best for the schools. It's not what anyone wants to have happen. But unfortunately, these language items have been negotiated into contracts and have had this particular result. This bill will take care of that. When the Minneapolis principals heard about this bill and actually visited extensively with Chair Sikora, they were thrilled at the prospect that you would pass this. So we know that the issues are big here with the teachers. We certainly do disagree with them on that. But we are very, very firmly behind this bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. And you have one more testifier, Mr. Bartholomew. And if the three testifiers may want to just stay close by if there's any questions for them also. Yes, and then we also have Ms. Hermanson and Ms. Allswiger, too, right after Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I'll just be very quick because I think you've heard a lot of good arguments already. The partnership does support House File 1831, and I guess basically for three reasons. One, we just think it's a critical component for management to be able to get their employees into the areas of responsibility that they think they can have the greatest positive impact. The second reason was we think this may have a positive effect on trying to reduce staff mobility as well as, you know, to the degree that teachers or that management doesn't have the ability to keep teachers in a school site if that's most appropriate. Staff mobility can be as big a problem as any other. And then finally, on page 3, we do support the notion that to the degree possible, assignments of teachers should occur before the start of the school year. We think that's for students, and Mr. Kite mentioned it briefly, that makes a great deal of sense. So with those quick points, again, we do support House File 1831 and hope you would be able to support it as well.
Thank you. All right, we have Ms. Hermanson, and you would like to come up.
Member Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rose Hermanson. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. What was cited just previously in the conversation is one of the biggest areas of concern. I've had distributed to the committee and a summary of the Minneapolis, what we call the transfer and reassignment policy. And I'd also encourage you to take down the following website. It's mft59.org. And on that website, they have all the language of the contract, and you can go in and read all of that language. They don't have the current contract, the new one that was just negotiated, but this part of the contract has changed a little, but not a lot, and you can read the language yourself. Just one couple quick comments and overview. I think we view educating our students as a partnership with shared responsibility. We've had a strong history of collaboration with the district. We do alternative compensation. I think the union's been very progressive. Shared responsibility also means shared decision-making in our mind. That should include the decisions around the education of the student and who does it. The handout describes the process in Minneapolis. I'll leave that for you to read. I would just like to draw your attention to a couple points. They're basically at the middle of the document. Teachers are interviewed by site teams for schools and vacancies. If there's an opening, that's when the teacher is allowed to transfer. If you go down just below that, a teacher seeking a transfer out of a building must have the principal sign off on that ability to do a voluntary transfer. If you read the details of some of the comments that were made earlier, I think if you look at, in particular, the Minneapolis arrangement, this is not necessarily accurate based on what's in practice and policy and in the contract in Minneapolis. Teams interview and select teachers through a process. The teacher applies for the opening on a website. They go through an interview with the site team, and if a teacher is teaching wishing a voluntary transfer, they not only have to have permission of their site team to do that, they also have to be agreed to be accepted by the new site as well. I would encourage you to read through this document. We on the backside explains what happens. All this process is done by June, so there's plenty of time to make decisions about hiring. Quite frankly, Minneapolis is in the position of laying off teachers, so it's not, you know, although there are still openings for areas of shortages that they will be hiring, the superintendent, in agreement with the union, have established some priorities about recall and hiring, and they are honored. We oppose Senate File 18, House File 1831. I've shared this with Representative Demmer. We think it conflicts with other laws. It conflicts with PELRA and the negotiations law of contracts. We have found that some districts have these provisions in meet and confer. They've developed them through an agreement in meet and confer. This would also prohibit meet and confer agreements, as I read it. We also have a statute that deals with peer review, which you mandate that there's a peer review process that people go through in relationship to evaluation and assessment of staff and their capabilities. So I think we should look very carefully before we pass this law. I would just like to read briefly what's in the preamble in that contract about what the transfer and reassignment procedure has as its goal. It's facilitating the best match possible of teachers and sites or programs seeking teachers. The parties to this agreement, which is the school board and the teachers, wish to promote or enhance the effectiveness of sites, programs, and professional educators through a process to facilitate teacher placement. The desire is based on several things: strengthening a system that improves quality education, student learning, and student school success, values the seniority status of teachers, provides schools with diverse teaching staffs, provides stability of staffs at all sites, and makes the best match possible of teachers and sites and programs. And finally, to allow the district to hire the best qualified teachers. We want to work in partnership with our district. We think we've done that responsibly in the contract arrangement. And I will let you read the details of the process and also invite you to look at the contract and make that decision for yourself. We have acted responsibly. We want to work with the district, not be at odds with them in a confrontational way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hermanson. Ms. Halsweiger, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. As I've stated to Representative Demmer, we understand the intent, and but what we have a concern about is it seems to be a statewide solution to a perceived, and I want to emphasize perceived, problem. Superintendent Charlie Kite testified that there are just a few locals, few school districts that have these. In fact, I come from a school district where sometimes it was really difficult to get out of the building that you were in. I wanted to. I was considered a very good teacher, and I myself didn't want to leave. But we have provisions that actually are restrictive on transfer. Now you would say you can't even have those. So when you think that you are solving this whole problem, you may actually be causing more problems. You are giving, with this bill, supreme authority to the superintendent to make these decisions without collaboration, and voluntary generally works better than involuntary. When you make some decisions with mutual agreements and voluntary decisions, you generally have individuals going to positions because they want to, because they're excited about it, because they're energized, and they're probably going to do a better job with kids. As compared to someone who is, let's say, a third grade teacher who is moved to sixth grade, if you have not been in a third grade classroom or in a sixth grade classroom and recently, go in there and see the difference between those kids. And I could even make a bigger example of a first grade to sixth grade because that licensure is the same. So let's just say you teach sixth grade and all of a sudden they need somebody in third grade. Wouldn't you want to ask for volunteers instead of saying, oh, I as Mr. and Ms. Superintendent am going to assign you to this third grade classroom? You're talking about significant changes in child development. You're talking significant changes in lesson plans and in instruction practices. You're talking, if I've been a teacher for sixth grade, for instance, for 6-7 years, to suddenly go to third grade would be a tremendous workload change. And you put that on top of being involuntary. I question whether you're going to make the changes that you really... changes for the better. I think I will conclude with those remarks. I think that there are far more unintended consequences. It seems to be a huge band-aid for a perceived problem when, and I will disagree with Mr. Aronson, they can negotiate it. They can fix the problem. All they need to do is sit at the table and figure out the problem. Thank you.
Mr. Aronson, could you come back up to the table? Because there's different, and Ms. Hermanson, maybe you can stay too. Just as far as the bumping rights issue, I think that's, you know, where the frustration is. It's not about an opening that may be created. It's just basically when something is opened up and the opportunity for a senior teacher to move into maybe a more desirable building, and so they, you know, there's this kind of bumping rights thing going on. Mr. Aronson, you stated that the principals really like this, and then we have this handout that talks about the process that's available. Is there something broken about this process that is, I guess, you know, I can read this and say, well, it looks like, you know, this is a pretty fair way of doing things, but what happens, where is it broken in the process where the system bogs down and we get the, reports in the paper that that there are classes that don't have a permanent teacher for 6 weeks into the session. Mr. Aronson.
Madam Chair, members, the memo that you have, and I'm just looking at this right at the moment, but this memo, it appears to me, relates to when the district is laying off teachers. And you're saying no to me here in my ear. It says, district sends budget to schools. Schools make staffing decisions based on budget teacher placement process. But let me give you the overview as to how this works in Minneapolis. There's two major influences on this. One is the state statute that relates to the tenure rights of teachers. That provides for the laying off of teachers on a district-wide basis in the inverse order in which they were employed in their area of licensure. This bill doesn't do anything with that. It doesn't change that at all. What we're talking about are internally negotiated procedures for not laying off people, but for bumping around within the district. And what happens in Minneapolis is that when there are any vacancies in a district, in a position, the teachers have rights based on their seniorities in those. We do a multiple series of what we call bidding in Minneapolis, and to where the teacher may at first say, I'll come to Segrin Elementary, but then if next, as a result, someone else moves from Crow Elementary, we do a second round of bumping, and the teacher says, well, I'm not coming to your school, I'm going to go to Crow Elementary, and then that when that opened up yours, we do another round of bumping and move another teacher in there. What the principals say is that they get a list on, you know, the first day of school of meeting their teachers and who they are. It is a very convoluted process. If during the school year, for example, one of our teachers leaves, retires, dies, whatever, so there's a vacancy during the school year, and we hire Teacher Strom, who's a new probationary teacher, to fill that spot at the end of the year, and assume that he works out. At the end of the year, we have to move him out of that spot and make that spot available for other teachers who are senior to him who may want that spot. I mean, it's this type of process that is going on instead of a circumstance where we could say, we think that Teacher Demmer would really do a good job at the Phillips School. It's in the poorest neighborhood in the district. Has a real tough time there. We think he would work out real well there. We can't do that under the current entanglement of procedures that exist in Minneapolis. They're not all bad. I mean, they were well-intentioned, I think, at their start. That's not what we're saying, and I can't get painted in the corner to say it that bad. But currently, it really does tie our hands, and significantly for assigning people, keeping people. So, Madam Chair, does that answer kind of what you're asking me?
Well, it does partially. It's a complex issue, and you know, I can understand the teacher's position too, of wanting to be able to have a little bit of charge of their destiny. Also, there just seems to be some way, some middle ground to get to this, because it seems like the one process is really cumbersome, and it's just not allowing for some common sense. We've got two questions. Let's get to the questions, because I don't want to dominate the question period, but if you guys just want to stay there. Representative Goodwin, and then we'll have Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Demmer, it sounds to me like this is a Minneapolis problem that we're trying to solve statewide, and I've got a great respect for the bargaining process, a great respect, and I've been involved in it several times, and it is a process that allows both sides to negotiate and get what they want. I have a real problem with any bill, and particularly one that doesn't have a very serious, compelling reason to insert the state into the bargaining process. And Mr. Bartholomew comes up here from the chamber, and I'm wondering how he would feel if there was a bill before us that specifically inserted the state in negotiations and contracts between businesses. I think this is no different than that, and I think that we need to be very careful with doing anything that will put the state in the middle of making demands on the bargaining process. I think this problem can be solved in Minneapolis, or if it exists in another district, through that negotiation process, and I think that it should. I really have a problem with putting this in state law.
All right, we have a question from Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Either to Ms. Hermanson or Ms. Alschwager, what in this bill negates the information you've provided us for teachers to have a process? Is it simply that the board must not enter into an agreement which limits? I mean, what is it? Because, Ms. Alschwager, you said that it will negate or it'll take away the restrictions already in place.
Ms. Oschweiger, maybe get an extra chair. Yeah, just bring an extra chair up. That would be fine. Ms. Oschweiger.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'll try to go back to the district that I came from. Right now in the contract, the way the situation works, it's spelled out very clearly. All the principals, the superintendent, and the teachers understand exactly what the transfer policy is. I'm not going to get into all the specifics, but basically there's an open window period of time when the principals decide these are the jobs that are available. Anybody who's interested says, yes, I'm interested. They go through a process of hiring, and in this district they're very collaborative. Collaborative is good. Agreements are good. Where the principal and members of the teaching staff in this school that has an open position interview, let's say me, as a teacher who's already in another district, and they decide who gets that job. That is in the contract. It is part of the agreement. It works. By passing this law, you are basically saying that you can't let them have that agreement that is already working. If you pass this bill, my guess is you're going to have more superintendents possibly coming forward and saying, we want to be able to define the process. We want to come to an agreement with our teachers, with our administrators, with our superintendent, school board members, to say this is a process that works. We want to put it in writing. As I am not an attorney, but as I would read this, it would mean that we couldn't bargain it, and I would guess you could not have a letter of understanding or a memo of understanding to say that this is the process. I think you're putting an incredible burden on superintendents to say, this is how we're going to do it. And I think you'd have a far better process if you have an agreement that is worked out with teachers, administrators, school board members, superintendents, that spells it out, and it creates stability, understanding of the process versus unrest.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. I wouldn't presume to speak for superintendents or principals, but in our interpretation of agreement that's in the bill, agreement is drawn very broadly. I am assuming it means a contract, which is an agreement, a memorandum of understanding, which is an agreement, or even some policy that may be developed through meet and confer. And I've done a little research on districts that have a transfer and reassignment agreement, and they are all three. In particular, I've got the Minneapolis here. I really do encourage you to go in and read that contract and judge for yourself. We think that we've given principals a great deal of latitude along with their school sites in making the decision as to the best staff for their buildings. I'm not sure what the particular issues that Mr. Arnson is referring to, but that's a decision you're going to have to make reading the language, reading what we perceive as the process.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank you for your comments about leaving some space for teacher autonomy or self-determination. I'm struck by a contrast between yesterday and today, because yesterday, and I'm forgetting the name of it, the Red Book, not Mao, the Red Book that was in our folders yesterday, the folks who weren't able to come.
The Teaching Commission.
Thank you, the Teaching Commission. In there, what they talk about for the issue that Mr. Aronson raised about how do we get good quality teachers in these really hard schools, they talk about incentives. Oh, thank you, Ms. Larson. They talk about incentives. They talk
Bingo,
about
super teachers.
That actually isn't the governor's proposal as the commissioner presents it.
That was rude of me.
No, it's quite all right. It wasn't as good as the zing on Representative Greiler yesterday, but it wasn't bad.
That's close.
But I think what we know about human nature is that people respond much better to carrots than they do to sticks. And the Teaching Institute folks talk about carrots, and Representative Demmer talks about sticks. And I'm just struck by the contrast. I do have a question for Representative Demmer. I believe in real life you're a small businessman. Am I right about that?
Yes.
The question then is, you enter into contracts with vendors who feed your business whatever it is you need, whether it's utilities or something. I'm not even clear in my mind what you do right now, but you enter into contracts.
Sure, for the sake of this, yeah.
Okay.
I may enter in contract.
Okay. If there is a problem that develops over the life of that contract, do you go back to the vendor in an attempt to renegotiate, or do you come to the state legislature in an attempt to do an end run around the contract?
Mr. Representative Demmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, if I'm doing my job properly as owner and or manager of that business, I keep myself in a position where I have say and control, and I don't enter into any contracts that box me into a situation where I don't have the say. So I like to be in control and have the ability to use my management either expertise or non-expertise to work with whatever situation there is. And you can talk contracts, you can talk employees, you can talk vendors, you can talk customers. I like to be in a position where my skill, my training, if you will allow me to make a decision that will allow me to either excel or to fail. And I'd like to be in that position of control as a manager and owner.
All right. Representative Biernet, you had a question.
Thank you.
Question or a statement, either one today.
Madam Chair, a question for staff first and then a question for the author. For staff, the language on page 3 from 13 to 24, was that deleted in another bill that we have before us? So it's still before the committee, because I think that language should go, and as long as it's still before our committee, I hope we don't forget about it, because I think that's impossible language. Let me speak now to the author, because, and I'm speaking as a former school board member in Minneapolis, and what this bill seems to do is to really restrict the power of the school board. And you know, we can see this on, again, page 3, the superintendent visits schools, makes recommendations to the board. Recommends employment to the board, and suddenly you're saying the board doesn't have this kind of control anymore. The board can't tell what the superintendent what to do. When I was on my, I think, my second or third year on the board, we had a superintendent who decided that he wanted all principals to have a new perspective. So he was going to transfer every principal. And the board said no. That would cause instability. There are some principals that had only been there 1 year, but he decided he was relatively new and he just wanted to shake things up. And so what you're doing is taking away completely the power of an elected school board and saying, we think the superintendent, although the superintendent is supposed to report to the school board, is smarter, can make the better decisions, and to transfer teachers and administrators on a whim or any other thing without consulting the school board. And you know, I think that's really a change in power, a dramatic shift in power. And why would anybody want to be in the school board if you can't do anything? Because you've got a superintendent who has all the power.
Thank you for that question or statement or Representative Demmer.
Response.
Madam Chair, Representative Biernet, I appreciate that, but I respectfully disagree with your approach to this. As a former school board member, I found it much easier to work through my superintendent and have an effect and have an ability to affect my school district if I could work through my superintendent and get things done, as opposed to having to go through some sort of process that was set up through a labor negotiated situation. Because the superintendent works for the school board, period. And the school board, as a school board member, felt at any given time, I and my six other board members could have a direct effect on that superintendent the way he did things. Your example I'll take as a case in point. A superintendent came in and said he wanted to rearrange principals. The school board had the ability and the authority to go in and say, no, we don't want you to do that. If we don't put something like this in place where I believe school boards negotiate away inherent managerial rights, which is, I believe, what we're talking about here, the school board, in effect, would not have the ability to tell the superintendent, no, you can't do that, because it would be out of the superintendent's control. So, quite frankly, I think this empowers school boards even more if these things are kept within the control of the superintendent, the management of the school district, to be able to work with that school district and its employees and staff.
All right. Representative Klensing. And we've got three more questioners, our statement makers after this, and then we're going to move on to our next bill. Representative Klensing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I'll ask for some indulgence, as this is not a statement, but two clarifications that I think need to be made about the statutory language proposed here. First of all, on page 1 in line 9, it says the board must superintend and manage the schools of the district. But if we flip to page 3 and look at line 8, that duty now is for, in that specific area of management, it's the superintendent must superintend. So there's a conflict, I think, in the language as to who's doing the superintending. The board, who has the last say, the board or the superintendent? So I guess I need a clarification on that point first.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, could you tell me the two places you thought were conflicting again?
Certainly. Page 1, line 9.
Madam Chair and members, just at first glance, it does say that the board superintends, and later on it says the superintendent superintends. I would have to agree with Representative Klinzing. I guess I would defer to maybe Mr. Strom and, or Ms. Larson in terms of without having a chance to let it soak a bit.
Ms. Larson. Madam Chair, members, perhaps the intent, despite all those words, was really to refer to a sign. So you might consider deleting superintendent, superintend the assignment of, and just say assign.
Madam Chair and Ms. Larson, where would you say we should do that?
On page 3, line 8, delete superintend the assignment of, and insert assign.
Madam Chair and Ms. Larson, instead, just scratch out superintend and replace it with assign.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, you need to delete superintend the assignment of and insert the word assign. Since I believe that the new language on page 1 talks about the duty of the superintendent to assign and reassign. And you could say assign and reassign to be consistent.
Mm-hmm. Representative Demmer, would you like to make that motion to say assign or reassign?
Madam Chair, I'm fine with that language. I think assign should cover it as far as I can.
Assign or reassign?
Assign or reassign.
Okay.
I think that's the intent is to allow the superintendent to assign and reassign teachers.
All right. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, one more.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The new language on page 1, line 16, that the board must not enter into an agreement which limits a district superintendent's duties. When I go to 123B.04, which for those of you who don't have the statutes in front of you, is the site-based, site decision-making agreement language, it says that the school board may require, or says the school board or school site decision-making team may request the school board enter into an agreement with the school site decision-making team concerning the government's management or control of the school. And it goes on to say that this they may do in this agreement may be a provision that would allow the team to determine who is hired into and licensed and non-licensed positions. Is it your intent, Representative Demmer, to have this include site-based decision-making agreements?
Representative Demmer?
Madam Chair, Representative Klinzing and members, I think this would not prevent that from happening. It keeps it under the control of the superintendent, but there's nothing here that says a superintendent can't put those sorts of agreements and work with teachers and work with the other people in the school to do a reassignment. It does not say he can't set up committees of teachers for hiring. It does not say he can't take advice from teachers. It doesn't even say he can't meet with them and let them decide. It just says it's up to him to take care of that.
Madam Representative Chair. Cleansing.
The way I'm reading the law, as it is in law right now, though, that agreement would be between the board and the site-based school, and the superintendent wouldn't necessarily have to be part of that decision. So I think that there would have to be some sort of reference in the statute to that if we're going to change that agreement.
Mr. Kite, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, you work on site-based stuff, too. How would that, is there a glitch in there that would need to be fixed? Or?
Representative Cleansing and members of the committee, I'm not sure I have the exact answer to your question, but let me just make a couple of quick references. I spent 20 years as a superintendent. I was in a district that did not have language that limited the right of assignment in a contract. But we also were in a district that believed very deeply in building-level decision-making and being real inclusive of all of our of people in their decisions. And it seems to me that districts, this particular bill doesn't limit the ability of a school district and the superintendent, et cetera, to be collaborative. The best of the processes, and the processes that I personally used and most of the colleagues that I worked with used, really very, very seldom used ultimate power and instead used collaborative power or collaborative processes. And it would be ideal to have the buildings, each building making us the decisions that they could in that building for assignment and so forth. But one of the reasons this bill, they talk about the level of the superintendent, is that you also sometimes have to work with issues that go between buildings. And you may well come to the beginning of a school year where there are 100 less children in one building and 100 more in another building. And what you really have to do is get three teachers moved across from one building to another. And in the school districts I worked with, we would first look for volunteers. We would try every process to try to get people to move voluntarily, get the right mix of people. But I have to tell you that on occasion, as a superintendent, I had to use my power to say, this person has to move. And on occasion, I had to force what I would call an involuntary type of an assignment. But in good collaborative districts, that happens very, very seldom. And this bill doesn't limit the ability to be collaborative.
All right, so it hasn't quite addressed the issue, but that's something that I think we need to raise and maybe clarify in the future. I think it's a good point. We have two more, and then we need to move on because we've also got three more bills to get through. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see both sides of this issue. I've gone through seven or eight different superintendents. Some were good and some weren't quite as good. None of them seem to be as good as you were, sir. But our district is really, where I come from, nothing's broken. In fact, we settle contracts early. The masses get upset that the union is too tight with the school board and settle too fast, but things are good. I'm a little bit leery of a statewide fix for a Minneapolis problem, if there is one. I guess that's the way I see it.
All right. That was a statement. Representative Greiling, do you have a statement? Or
Madam Chair, you know me well. I just have a statement. A statement for Representative Demmer. He mentioned being a school board member, he found it worked best working with the superintendent and the principals. And I would say, having been a school board member also, as well as a teacher, that I have always found it works better if you include everybody in decisions and work together. And if you just work with one side, teachers can be very passive-aggressive if they're unhappy about where they've been sent. And I think you do have a legitimate concern with all new teachers or probationary teachers. I think Mr. Aronson brought that up, being in, you know, packed up in the harder schools. That was the case way back in the dark ages when I was teaching. And I was in a hard school, and we had a lot of new teachers. And that is a problem, and teachers who choose to go where they want often, you know, need a relief from a school like that. So I think you've identified a real problem, and I want to, you know, compliment you for that. I don't believe this is the solution. I think it might serve to make, you know, some things worse by sending people where they don't want to be, and then they're unhappy about it. But I do think we do need to address the issue of, you know, the more inexperienced teachers in the harder schools, because that impacts the achievement gap. And, you know, research shows that really good teachers, kids learn more. And so I think you've put your finger on a real problem. I want to compliment you for that and hope you'll continue working on a real solution.
Thank you. Representative Demmer, I'll let you wind up, then we must move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if you listen to all the conversation we've had here today, members and Madam Chair, it really boils down to, are we concerned that a superintendent is not going to do a good job working with his staff? And I would submit to you that we cannot legislate good management. We cannot legislate an agreement that says a superintendent will do this because we think it's the best way for him or her to manage that school. I believe it's very important to also consider the fact that I don't think we're really creating anything new. In my opinion, quite frankly, we're making very clear that you don't negotiate away inherent managerial rights. Managers of businesses, managers and superintendents of schools are there to manage the schools. There is a line between the people who are staff members and the people who work there and the people who are ultimately responsible for the management and the functioning of the place. Now, I would agree 100%, and I think you'd find the people that work for me directly in my own business, as well as my opinion about how you'd run a school, would be collaborative. You work with people. People don't work for you. They work with you. But there are still clear lines of responsibility that have to stay clear. And I don't think that in this day of superintendents do not have tenure. Superintendents are basically held accountable in the end. If a school does not do well, look to the administration of the school. The administration, this is the management of the business, is who you look to when things don't go well. And when you put superintendents and or managers or principals, whatever, but superintendents in this case, in a position where they don't have control, they can't make the decisions that they think they have to make, they can't institute the kind of collaborative policies that they would like to institute to run the place the best it can be, I think we're putting one hand behind their back and then saying, now you're being held accountable. So, members, I think this is an important piece of legislation to clarify that it's an inherent managerial right to manage the school, to allow the superintendents to be either a good superintendent or to be a bad superintendent, and allow their consequences to be as follows. So I would like to renew my motion to pass this and for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you. We need
to request
a
roll call.
We're not, we're just laying this over for consideration. I got all excited to that other one. We did pass one today.
My mistake.
So. Yeah. We'll have those roll calls in a couple of weeks here. Representative Hilty is up next. Thank you, Representative Demmer. House File 2116. The minutes of March 10th need to be approved. Representative Biskins? Oh, he's not here. Representative Erickson will move the minutes of March 10th. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition, the minutes of March 10th are approved. Welcome, Representative Hilty. And you're here to save us some money. You are a hero. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am here today to hopefully bring some closure to an ongoing saga in one of the school districts in my district. I have with me today one of the good superintendents, Mr. John Cambrone, who's the superintendent of the East Central School District. What House File 2116 does, two things. One, it simply provides the authority for the school district to sell its middle school building, which is located in Asco, Minnesota. And it also asked for forgiveness for the outstanding balance on that loan. And I will defer to Superintendent Cambrone to give the committee a little bit of the history of the situation and what we hope to accomplish.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Superintendent Cambrone.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee, for just a brief review of what's happened in my district. Approximately 3 years ago, I came before this committee and was, with your support, was able to capture a capital loan to build a new K-12 facility, which, by the way, is 2 months ahead of schedule and at or below every line item on the budget. So I thank you for that. Because of that new construction, which was a result of major indoor air quality issues, we have now completed and will occupy this new building next fall. As part of that, the Asco Middle School has been put out for bids per State Statute 16A, and the Assistant Commissioner of Finance has approved of the sale of the building. With that, we would like to offer this bill so that we can resolve that old capital loan, which, given the financial status of the community and the district, would sunset at this point in time. Approximately, looking back at the records for your information, over the last 10 years, the district has paid towards interest in that old capital loan of approximately $1.5 million. And that was per Mr. Kiesel from the Department of Education. This bill has no impact whatsoever on the state finances. What it does is it allows us to concentrate on the new capital loan for the building and put all our energies in that, and therefore have a higher chance of paying that back as soon as possible. We are at our maximum payback to the state, and so the financial impact to the state will be nothing.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Hilty? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Hilty, I'll move the bill for you, House File 2116, to be before our committee for consideration in the K-12 bill. This is a pretty straightforward bill. It actually will, they will use this $215,000 to help settle the debt or make an attempt to pay this debt. As the superintendent said, they've been trying to pay this off, and the interest kind of keeps them from ever actually paying off the principal, because there's an interest accrued, and that's what happens in some of these property poor districts. Even if we had gone out to the 30-year max, at the 30-year, if they had not fulfilled their obligation, the loan would have been forgiven. We're basically saying sell the building, we'll take the proceeds and make it good, and they will continue making the maximum effort now on their consolidated and they also you've also consolidated within that time.
Correct.
There's been a number of circumstances that caused a lot of this to happen. There are no further questions. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the building being sold at fair market value?
We put it out for bids, and that was the highest bids by a significant number. The problem with old school buildings is how do you determine fair market value and use? The firm that has purchased the building will be putting it on the tax rolls, and it will add to the Asco community both in jobs and taxes.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you. Good question. Are there any other questions? No? All right. Thank you, and we appreciate your coming down here and testifying.
It's appreciated.
Thanks, Representative Hilty. The next bill is Representative Adolphson, House File 2204. I slaughtered your name. I apologize.
Thank you, Chairman Segrin. I want to send you to remedial phonics class for it. It's okay.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Is Senator Hand here? I saw him. Oh, why don't you come on up? Welcome. We allow senators to come up occasionally. You're welcome.
Did you want to move my bill?
Yes, I'll be glad to move House File 2284 for consideration, or not 2204, I'm sorry, to be before our committee for consideration.
Thank you, Chairman Seeger and members of the committee. House File 2204 is a simple bill that would allow local control for school boards. The bill is a May bill that will authorize them to adopt a fee schedule for pupil transportation services. It would require the districts to establish fee guidelines so that no student is denied transportation solely on the inability to pay a fee. And it limits the total fees to not more than the prior year's fees adjusted for the increased costs or expanded student transportation services. And it has a three-year period that we would have it to run on. With me today is Dr. Melissa Kroll, Superintendent of Eden Prairie Schools, and Patricia Magnuson, Executive Director of Business Services, and of course, Senator Hahn is available also.
And I would like to welcome Superintendent Kroll. I'm misrepresenting Eden Prairie School District.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Don't have them anymore, but I still follow Eden Prairie very closely.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing our testimony today. We're here to tell our story. It's really an Eden Prairie story in terms of how this particular bill has played out in Eden Prairie and how the effects of this bill will play out in the future. So what we'd like to do is just tell you our story and let you know how we've instituted a transportation fee and what effect it has had on our district. Historically, if you go back to the year 2003, we were in the middle of making about a $5 million budget reduction. And that was about 7% of our general fund. At the time, we were in the midst of making severe cuts throughout the budget, which predominantly were affecting class size and in addition to a variety of other places within the district. What we felt we needed to do is take a look at transportation so that we could sort of spread the deficit and the reductions out throughout the district. And as a result, we took a serious look at transportation and looked at our options. We were looking for about $430,000 that we had to continue to reduce to bring balance to our budget. We knew we had some constraints, but we also had some choices. So let me just tell you some of the choices that we faced before we made this decision. We knew that one of our options was to simply eliminate transportation completely within the two-mile radius of our schools. And we knew that we could do that by law, and we knew that the resulting amount that we could save would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $144,000 to $180,000. We also knew as a second choice that we could create a walking area, maybe even a limited walking area as far as 1 mile. We knew we could do that. The savings would be less. That would be in the neighborhood of $72,000 to $90,000. We also considered changing our start times. We knew that there would be savings there. That would be in the neighborhood of $126,000. And we also finally considered the option to continue to provide transportation as a fee to all families in the district and also families within the two-mile area. That savings could come to about $400,000+ for us. So due to the history and the layout of our community, we knew we would have some concerns resulting this institution of fees. We knew that, first of all, there's a limited number of sidewalks in our community, so walking would not necessarily be a great option for all of our families. We had to face that constraint if we were to institute the fee. We also knew that in our district, we've had a history of providing transportation for all families, whether they're within 2 miles or not, for a long period of time, and that could create that might create some unrest and dissatisfaction among our families. Thirdly, we knew that we might be creating some traffic congestion problems around our schools. We had had some congestion problems in the past, and we weren't interested in creating greater congestion due to the fact that more families would be transporting their children on their own if they would opt not to pay a fee. And finally, when studying the start time changes, we realized that changing start times was not a good option for our district. We had just finished a two-year study in changing start times and making significant improvements at our district so that high school started later, elementary started earlier. And so we weren't real interested in undoing that decision. And so in the end, we made a decision, and here's our decision. We decided to continue to provide transportation service to all families in the district. We would implement a fee for transportation within 2 miles of the district, and we would implement a scholarship program so that all families who were unable to pay the fee would have the option to ride. What we'd like to do now is tell you a little bit about how we implemented the program and the results of that program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patricia Magnuson. I'm the Executive Director of Business Services for Eden Prairie Schools, and I'm going to talk to you about how we implemented this fee and how it went for us. What we did once we made the decision to put a fee in place was created a committee. We had parents, we had bus drivers, police department, city officials, and school administrators putting some parameters around how we implemented the fee. We knew we have about 3,400 students that live within 2 miles, and so we established the fee at $300 per student, assuming that 50% of our families would take us up on the option to pay the fee. We've had free rides for all families that qualify for free or reduced price lunches. We have free rides for all students who require transportation under the constraints of their IEP for special education. And we have free rides for all kindergarten students. So those were the parameters that we put in place. We did not consider any of this a walking area. So we didn't make any provisions for hazardous criteria. Since we were putting a fee for transportation in place, we did not eliminate transportation. So walking was not one of our concerns for making the parameters. We chose a measurement system consistently that we would measure street center lines and the closest driving distance from the home to the school. And we put traffic plans in place in cooperation with the police department for all the school sites. We really geared up for safety and efficiency. Then we began just informing the families. We had open houses. We had articles in the newspaper. We had letters going out. And we also had a parent come forward and start a scholarship program to help families that didn't qualify for the free ride. So what happened was we were sort of pleasantly surprised. It wasn't the easiest thing I've ever done, or I don't think anyone in our district has ever done. But for the first year, when we had anticipated 50% of families would sign up for a ride, we actually had 61% of the families in the 2 mile area sign up for the ride, so we were able to right away reduce the fee from $300 down to $190. The school traffic issues went very well. We had very good cooperation from all our school principals and from the Eden Prairie Police Department, so traffic went very well. And what I would say is that our community has received the fee relatively well, and we still have a couple of areas of concern. One of them is that it places an inequity among our families. Those that live within 2 miles have to pay, and they don't understand why those outside of 2 miles have to pay, and it's just the limitations we have within the law. And there are some perceived safety issues because the community, on one hand, believes that we have created walking areas, although we contend that we haven't. We still provide transportation. It's the parent's choice to put their child to get their child safely to school. We provide the bus ride as a choice. So there's a perception of a safety issue. And just the last thing I want to share with you is we continue to try to find efficiencies in our transportation system, and we did do that and to try to make things better and more streamlined, and we were able to, for this current year, 03-04, again reduce the fee to $175. We're still trying to keep that original cut in place, but we found other savings in transportation. And that had mixed reception also from the community, but it's been relatively successful for us.
So concluding remarks regarding this bill, even as we speak, we're faced with rather significant reductions in our district that we're working on right now, so our hope is that we can maintain this reduction. And we intend to maintain this reduction either way. As Patricia mentioned, the most significant issue that rose up as a result of the implementation of the fees was inequity. That was the thing that seemed to concern the parents to the greatest degree. So the solutions that we would appreciate your help with, we do think this bill would help us with the particular issues we faced in Eden Prairie, specifically with the inequity. The ability to assess a fee to all members of our community would diminish the issue of inequity greatly to our families, and that seems to be the issue that rose up. And secondly, we think we can do that at a much lower cost per family if we have the ability to create greater balance with regard to this fee. So we would appreciate your support, and we do believe that this House file does support us on those particular issues. Senator Hamm?
Senator Hamm, would you like to make some comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for having us come and inviting me to testify. I can't really add much to what has already been said, except that I was on the board in Eden Prairie when we first had this issue come up, and the thing that it put the board in is a very unusual circumstance where we were trying to find a way to save some money without cutting into the basic core programs that we were offering to students. And we looked at transportation because there is this 2-mile perimeter or distance from a school site that the law says you do not have to provide transportation. And so that logically became an area that the board looked for, is can we save money by not transporting students within that 2-mile limit? But as was pointed out by Dr. Kroll and Patricia Magnuson here, that's really not a very acceptable solution for most districts. And so we did go to a fee structure, and we did what we could under the confines of the laws that exist today. And it is not perceived very well in the community, I think, in the sense of it's not being fair. You draw a line wherever it is, one side of the line, you pay a fee, to the side of the line, you don't. And so what we were trying to find is a way that if we do have a fee structure, if we could assess a fee equally across all riders, so that the fee would be minimal and there would not be a perception of unfairness in the community. And that's really the intent of the bill. And we've structured this in a minimalist way, if you will, setting up as a pilot program and having some restrictions on what the size of the fee might be and how it might grow. It's really covering increases in costs to transportation. And we wanted to see whether this approach would work. And after a couple of years, I think we might have some evidence of how well this has been received and how it might work. And would appreciate your consideration. And I think we'd be open for questions.
All right. We have Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Senator and testifiers. I think you've hit upon a good principle, which is that the more you spread out a tax, the fairer it is and, you know, the lesser it is for things that are priorities. And I think that the safety of our students when they're riding to school is a priority, and I compliment you for coming forward with a bill on that. I would submit that an even fairer way to put a tax for students who we prioritize would be on an even larger pool, which would be all the taxpayers of Minnesota. And I'm wondering why you've given up on advocating for that and come instead with this.
Representative Adolphson or Senator Hahn?
Well, I'll take a stab at it first. We started out, we wanted to keep it a fee for now. We didn't want it to expand all over. When you start talking levy, you run into a lot of other issues, I believe, and I think Senator Hahn might even be able to expand on it more. But this is a service provided within the school district to the students, and that's the target audience we were looking at initially, and we didn't really consider the levy aspect of it.
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, I think that we were trying to address a particular problem that had to do with transportation and the way the current law works. If a district, in the face of some kind of budget management, looked to try to find fees to help with their budget problem, and that really was what we were trying to focus on. We're not trying necessarily to solve the whole issue of how we finance education the question you've asked has raised a lot of, I think, peripheral issues that we really didn't want to try to tackle all those at once. We're really looking at, given the laws that exist today, and if districts are looking for ways to find some way to manage their general fund dollars, and they're faced with looking at a fee, can they do this in a way that is equitable? And that really is the problem that we're trying to focus on. And as much as the other issue raised is important and important to all of us, I'm not sure we're quite prepared to try to fix all that today. But we were trying to fix a very small problem.
Thank you. All right. Are there any other questions for the author, Representative Burnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My guess is that Eden Prairie has a very small percentage of free and reduced lunch students, so you have a large percentage of wealthier people who you can use revenue from funding. So that's a proper balance. But if you look at this issue statewide, and your bill in essence is a statewide bill, there are many districts that are primarily free and reduced like children. They're not going to be able to generate that. So it seems like it may be equitable in your district, but some districts are not going to be able to gather this additional revenue, and it seems like that would be somewhat unfair to them. A wealthy district can do this very easily. Parents are willing to pay $300, but a poorer district, an outlying district with higher transportation expenses, may not be able to do that. And it seems to me it may be fundamentally unfair from a statewide perspective.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Burnett, I'm not sure there was a question there, but I'll try to respond a little bit. I think clearly you're right that districts are different across the state and different characteristics obtained. There's nothing in the bill that would require any district to do anything different than what they do today. I think that, as districts look at how they're going to do transportation, to me there is virtue in providing some flexibility to deal with that as the local conditions permit. And as a board member in Eden Prairie, believe me, the first place you go to is not necessarily fees. That is never an easy choice to make. And I recognize that some districts that might be a better option than others, or it might be an option that some of the costs could be recovered by fee and some might be still carried under the general fund. What we're really trying to get at is there some room for flexibility for local boards and administrations to try to work into place a solution to a problem such as this in a way that's fair? And we just have felt that the constraint of the current law, any solution you come up with regarding fees, I think has an inherent equity issue for the district. And I recognize the point that across the state you are going to have different circumstances, and there may be other solutions that are more broad than what we're proposing that would help address that. But nothing in this bill would require anybody to do anything differently than what they're doing today.
Okay, we need to be real quick. We've still got one more bill to cover today. Representative Dabney, Eakin, and Erickson, and then we'll stop the questioning. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struck that there's no requirement that school districts use the funds generated for transportation. And it seems, picking up a bit off of Representative Greiling's concern about taxes versus fees, that a fee is a fee if it funds the service for which you're charging the fee. The fee is a tax if it's instead used to, in this case, kind of do an end run around the taxpayers in Eden Prairie who are being charged a fee for transportation, but that funding may end up going anywhere else instead. And I guess I'm wondering, Representative Adelson, why there's no requirement that fees generated by charging people for transportation don't go to fund transportation.
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair Segrin. Well, Representative Dabney, as I read it, it says a fee for transporting people to and from to school from home, basically. And as it's written there, I would interpret that as a fee for that service.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair. Representative Adelson, that language, as I read it, justifies the fee, but it doesn't determine what the fees, what the revenue generated by that fee can be used for. So you can, you could charge a fee for transportation and use the revenue to fund the, no offense, but the superintendent's automobile account, which is may well be a legitimate business expense, but you're not being straightforward with the taxpayers of Eden Prairie if you're billing them for one thing and using the funds for another, and there's not a requirement that the fund generated be tied to the activity being charged for.
Representative Dabney, I don't follow your questioning. The bill seems to be pretty clear that the fee is for our transportation to and from school for any people transported and for all other transportation services not required by law. It seems to be pretty specific that the fee is, that's what it's used for. I'm not following here. I mean, they can't, it's, that's what it's used for. They can't divert it.
I'm not seeing a limitation on their diversion. I'm seeing a rationale for why we're charging this. We're charging you, Mrs. Segrin, mm-hmm. $175 mm-hmm. to transport Timmy to school.
Right.
But then there's no requirement that $175 actually go into the transportation fund.
Mr. Segrin, is there some ambiguity?
I'm concerned that without that,
yeah,
it could go anywhere.
Mr. Trump.
Madam Chair, I think it was and the district could certainly speak to this, I think it's certainly the intent that the transportation fee would not exceed the cost of transportation services, but the language in the bill doesn't directly say that. But you could ask the folks from Eden Prairie where they set their fee amount, but I suspect their fee amount is still under the total cost of transportation services for those pupils.
Superintendent? Magnus?
It is, yes. In Eden Prairie, the amount that we set for fees went directly to transportation, and it does not cover the total amount of transportation at all. It's about half.
Okay. We have Representative Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And obviously, in the area of the state that I represent, which is rural Minnesota, transportation costs are a big factor in the expenses for our school districts. And Also, the income levels are lower in those areas as well, and I have a real concern about moving more and more in the direction of fees, where you're basically, you know, they're basically user taxes, where it, what you end up with then is in those low-income areas, they're not going to have the incomes necessary to cover, you know, adequately the costs of providing the service. And so I have some real concerns about that, and I see that's been the general direction that we've been moving in, I think, in the legislature this year, and there have been a lot of phony fees as well. I think that needs to be pointed out, you know, fees where the actual money is not going to the service being provided. But regardless of whether it's going to the service being provided or not, it's a dangerous precedent. It's going to end up, I think, leading to a greater disparity in the level of services being provided. And in our area, again, transportation is a major expense for us, and our income levels are very low. So I see this as taking a much larger chunk of the income of people living in our area and not resulting in any better services being provided. So I have a concern about that, I feel like what's next? You know, what are we going to be charging fees for next? We're going to have book fees next so that, you know, students are going to be paying out of their pockets so that people in my area will have students sharing books because they can't afford to buy all the books necessary. You know, what's next? Are we going to keep moving in this direction? And I think that we could probably and should probably start an organization called the Fee Payers League of Minnesota, which actually stands for working people.
To this point, Madam Chair, very quickly.
Well, we're going to have to meet after session or continue. Representative Johnson, can your testifiers come back? What's today? This is Thursday. On Monday.
Madam Chair, we can give our testimony in 6 minutes.
Well, then we need to finish up our questions here real quickly. Representative Erickson.
I'll pass.
Representative Krinke.
Madam Chair, I have a small amendment that I think would address the concerns that were raised by Representative Abney. On line 17, after the word district, delete the period, insert the words "and expended only for student transportation expenses."
All right. Is that acceptable, Senator Hahn?
Madam Chair, just one question on that.
Mm-hmm.
There is not really a transportation fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
mm-hmm.
To me, you know, money is fungible. You collect it. How would you make sure that the exact dollars you collected were spent for that exact cost?
There is no transportation reserve.
And so I'm not quite sure how you would assure that to happen other than just to make sure
good
that
point.
The total that you collected didn't exceed the total of the cost mm-hmm. of transportation itself.
Yeah.
Which I think is already addressed.
I think the proposed bill is very clear what it has to be used for. I just don't think it's necessary. And again, that's a good point. There are no other comments. I want to thank.
Madam Chair, I moved an amendment.
All right.
If
all
the
in
author
favor,
doesn't want the amendment, that's fine. I just moved the amendment for clarification.
Representative Adelson, do you want the amendment?
If it's the will of the committee.
All right. All in favor of Representative Krinke's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? No. All right. The amendment is adopted.
Could we have the staff read?
All right. That will be, 2204 as amended before our committee for consideration. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. The amendment is on line 17. Before the period, insert "and expended only for transportation services."
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you,
okay. House File 2284. I apologize to the witnesses who have come that you're going to be cut off.
Madam Chair, I'd move House File 2284 for consideration of possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
This is a short bill, and essentially what it does is it eliminates the excess levy referendum cap that is placed upon some of our school districts. Currently, that levy cap amount is at $855.79 for non-sparsity schools. There is no cap on sparsity schools, which are 79 of the districts in our state. There are several districts that are either at or over that cap, and many others that are within easy reach of that cap, both sparsity and non-sparsity school districts. I know there are real concerns among some of our members about the willingness or the ability of their taxpayers to raise taxes to the same level that other districts can, and I appreciate that concern, but the bottom line is, does it help kids to disallow some taxpayers to spend more of their own money on their schools? And I do not think so, and that is the impetus for this bill, Madam Chair. I would like to ask one of my superintendents, Paul Bialfus from the Wayzata District, to say a few words as well.
Welcome, Superintendent Bialfus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Thank you, committee members, for allowing us to be here. My name is Paul Bialfus, and I serve as superintendent of the Wayzata Public Schools. Today is an historic day for the Wayzata Public Schools. If you didn't know, it's the second time within 50 years that we are in the state hockey playoffs.
Oh, all right.
So we're quite enthusiastic in our school district with respect to that. I also served for 5 years as superintendent of Mankato, and I understand exactly outstate greater Minnesota issues as well as suburban issues. There's some myths that you should be alert to, and I know you know them, and also some realities. Let me give you some quick examples. In our school district, over the past 3 years, we have adjusted our budget $8.5 million. And that means that we have essentially laid off 65 teachers and the same number of paraprofessional or support positions. According to the recent research on behalf of the Taxpayers Association, not the Taxpayers League, we spend in our school district per pupil 1% less than the state average in Wayzata. We are very careful stewards of their taxpayers' taxes. In addition to that, recently I asked our business manager to give us a 5-year projection for our school district. We use a Citizens Financial Advisory Council, about a dozen members of our community who come together about monthly to give us advice with respect to our school district's finances. They helped establish assumptions for those budget forecasts. What we have forecast in this session for ourselves is that we believe that with reasonable assumptions that you would increase the basic foundation aid formula at 2% after next year for each of the next 3 years after that, and that we have reasonable expectations for salary benefits, health insurance, cost of supplies, materials, etc., we believe that our school district will be $13 million in the red in 5 years, given those conditions or those assumptions I just made for you. And again, if I were a high-spending superintendent, I would apologize for that, but we're very careful with our expenditures. We did have a successful referendum campaign last fall, 2003, due to your support to allow us to ask the community to accommodate us for inflationary increase for the excess operating levy referendum cap. We were successful in that. I have to share with you, however, that amount did raise in our school district $300,000. No small sum, but when our community members look at the substantial deficits that we're going to be facing over the next year, 2-3 years out, they asked us why we didn't ask for more money, particularly parents would like to support us. Right now, 31% of our high school classes have 37 or more youngsters in our high school classes. We've continued to raise class sizes in our school district in order to accommodate, obviously, our budgets. We can only control, as you know, the expenditure side. At least at this point. So what this bill would allow is an opportunity for us to gain some additional revenue. We have a legislative action committee. It's made up of a group of parents from each of our school sites who come together regularly, and they have initiated a new initiative among them, and that is to make contacts with outstate and greater Minnesota school districts, school boards, superintendents, and hopefully legislators in order to find some common ground, because we're all struggling, as you know, with controlling expenditures and also with the difficulty of obtaining additional revenue. I think it comes down to, for us, local control matters. Our Twin West Chamber of Commerce, which is a large chamber representing 5 school districts in our western suburban area, through the Government Affairs Committee, supports this position. to eliminate the cap on excess operating levy referenda. Basically, the rationale there is because of the local control issue. So, as again, we can only control our expenditures at this point, not our revenue, and what this would allow us to do and other school districts to do would be to go back to voters and ask them if they're willing to spend more money. I think all parents and community members in all school districts want the best educational opportunities for their children. This is one of the strategies that we think would be helpful to us.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Hyde Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be directed at Mr. Strum.
Mr. Strum.
Okay. In what way will this affect any of the rural schools with sparsity aid, et cetera? Would it affect them at all, this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Heigarten, no, the rural schools that are eligible for sparsity revenue are currently exempted from the referendum cap, so they would remain exempt under this bill from the referendum cap.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will there not, however, be an indirect impact on maybe the level of funding from, from the state level? I see the possibility here of, this is a way for higher income school districts to kind of, fund their own schools without having to rely so heavily on state funding. This would decrease the pressure from those areas to increase funding from the state for public education purposes, which would have an adverse effect on our rural communities because, again, we don't have that option available in rural Minnesota with the high property tax base that they do in the wealthier suburban areas. So would there not be possibly an indirect impact?
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, yes, I think that these arguments are certainly debatable as to whether removing the cap would increase the spread for between high and low revenue districts and also whether that would affect support for public education. I think that's something to debate with the members. I'm not sure that there's research conclusively one way or the other about that, but it certainly would be a potential outcome of that.
Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I strongly support this bill because of a couple of things. One, because the state isn't funding education adequately, and also, and I think I've had this discussion with you, Representative Eakin, I think, your fears are unfounded in the sense that since we have gone to capping, we haven't increased the pressure and the support and for education funding. It's been quite the reverse. And as much as the rural schools have hoped by holding down the metro schools that then people would come forward and want to fund schools more and be united, it hasn't worked out that way. I think there was a stronger pressure when the school districts that didn't pass the levies or weren't able to were able to point to the other districts had so much money and they needed to catch up. And so then they had a stronger case in that regard. I think it was a worthy experiment to see if that would be how it would turn out. We'd all be pressuring the legislature to fund schools, but it's worked the other way around. And so I think that because the legislature hasn't done right by schools, now we need to at least let the communities who are able to go forward, and then that will point out what the taxpayers are willing to support, and then all schools have a good argument for the state doing better.
And to Representative Eakin, we did put $39 million into equalization so that all districts have the ability to access at least $500 of equalization aid. In most of these communities have been frozen now, the ones that are, at the cap. There has been no movement. So really, while other districts have, at least with equalization aid, have had some ability to raise some additional funds and have the state, pick that up, these districts don't get much aid. My district gets 3 cents of aid. That's it, as far as equalization. In essence, my district pays every referendum that we raise is all local, and the people that decide that and they support it, and they know that it's all going to come right out of their pockets. There's not going to be any state help for that. Versus, other districts will, you can vote for a $500 referendum and essentially know that the state is going to pick up most of that. And pay for it, and so you'll get another additional $500. Now districts have been at this cap for a number of years, and for 6 years ago, we put $1 billion into education. We put a lot of money on the formula. We did it again 4 years ago, and now, you know, we're at this crisis situation where we haven't been able to put any money on the formula, and we tried to soften that with the equalization, and so that people can go out with that have property poor districts and vote for basically some free money from the state if they wanted it. We put that money on the table for districts such as yours. Meanwhile, the districts in the other areas at the cap are pretty much, that's what they've got, and they've had that in their budget for years and years and years. And it's like anything. Now you are squeezed more and you have no other option. So, you know, we're basically saying it's time to take the cap off. If our citizens, regardless of age, our wealth, are willing to do that, then and tax themselves, then we ought to be able to be given the ability to do that. The cap was never intended to drive people down. It was supposed to be equalization. We've done tons of things for equity. We've really tried to do, and we've got many, many programs, compensatory, LEP, you name the programs that we've tried to address many. Transportation sparsity, transportation operating sparsity to address those issues. But it just seems like we can't recognize either through a cost differential. We had the debate the other day on that. No, we can't do that. Are allowing people to be able to tax themselves. No, we can't do that. We are a state, and we're all trying to work together, but it seems like it's, you know, that the metropolitan area can't seem to get any recognition of their needs. We have Representative Demmer, and then we probably need to go.
Madam Chair, quick question. Is there a cap on the amount of referendum that's equalized in rural Minnesota? Right. In other words, subject to these caps or whatever, but mm-hmm. subject to the, I can't remember the percentage, but subject to the cap that currently exists, if this were to go through, would this also eliminate the lid on any rural school districts? Could they levy as much as they wanted to and have it all equalized?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, no, the second tier of equalization aid is a fixed amount. Let me just grab the volume here, but there's a limit on that.
Okay, thank you. It's not important, the amount. I just know that would still remain fixed then. So in essence, we'd have metro school districts that would be able to levy unlimited, and in effect, we still have a lid on the non-metro then, it sounds like.
Madam Chair,
I
don't think that's accurate. There's a lid on how much equity you'd receive, but you certainly would have the same rights as sparsity districts already have to tax for your own taxpayers to tax themselves as much as they want.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Representative Johnson, there's no equalization aid. We don't get any equalization aid if we did this.
I understand, Madam Chair, but again, equal access to education for kids throughout Minnesota, I think that's the reason we have equalization. And if we quit equalization at a certain point in the school districts that get equalization, you effectively raise the cost. Again, property values and the amount of taxation per individual is the key here. And if we're going to go the route of everybody should tax everything the way they want to, then we shouldn't have levy limits, we shouldn't have prohibitions on sales taxes and all those things. So, I mean, I understand your argument, but we would need to be consistent then in all areas of taxation.
Yeah, but
if we're going to say
voter approval,
if we have voter approval,
you're leaving out voter approval. We don't. This is probably one of the only areas where we do have voter approval. And the point is, you know, if you're willing to tax yourselves and you're willing to go out to the voter, Mr. Strom, did you want to answer his question?
Madam Chair, this is a bit of a confusing point, and I may not have made it exactly right. There are limitations on the total amount of aid for a certain types of districts, and this was put in place a few years ago with some of the very low property wealth districts that essentially could leverage a great deal of state aid. And what the limitation says is that if essentially the referendum equalization aid equals 90% of the revenue or more, then the cap on the equalization aid applies. So it's a limited case. So for example, if your district is half aid and half levy, the removal of the cap would mean you'd get the lower amount of equalization aid all the way up. But if you were a very low property wealth district, the removal of the cap would limit you essentially to the, if you've got more than 90% of your referendum coming from aid, you'd be limited. Otherwise, you would not be.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. That's helpful. All right, we do have Mr. Lundell. Mr. Lundell, would you come on up, and if you've got, we've just got a couple of minutes and to hear your rebuttal. Welcome.
Very brief rebuttal, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Schools for Equity and Education. It's always hard to get up here and be even marginally disagreeable, especially to someone like Representative Johnson. We do, however, as an organization, oppose this bill. I think that there is one distinction that has to be made, though, that there are two different issues at play here. We think that this goes too far and that it gets rid of all caps. We believe that there needs to be a cap. I think in the case of Wayzata, in the case of Bloomington, in the case of some other districts that are at the cap, but not grandfathered, there is, I think, a pressure there that they are feeling that needs to be discussed. And I think that the 18.6 number, those types of things, are things that we're willing to dip into in discussion. I think that I'm trying to make a distinction here, though, that there is a valid difference between a cap and the cap that's currently in place. So I think that, but generally we do oppose the bill. I'll give it to John Regan here from our executive board and also superintendent at South Washington County for his comments.
Thank you. Welcome, Superintendent Regan.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's my privilege to be here. I'm superintendent of South Washington County, and that's Southeast Metro, Woodbury, Cottage Grove, St. Paul Park, and Newport. We have approximately 16,000 students, and we are at the referendum cap as a result of the November 2003 election. Prior to that, we lost three referendums, and I appreciate your comments on equalization because that is a huge reason why we're at the cap at this particular point. The removal of this cap would be very detrimental to the revenues for our district and our ability to pass referendums in District 833. Just a short story, very short. I was into Super America to get my gas this morning because I didn't think I'd make it here if I didn't. And Grandmother Eileen is one of our residents, and she asked me where I'm going, that I'm getting gas in the middle of the day. So the superintendent had to defend himself, and I just said, I'm going down to testify on this bill to remove the cap. She says, I don't think you ought to remove that cap. You guys are out here every 2 to 3 years, and that's enough. And that would be sufficient. And she says, oh, tell them not to remove the cap, and tell them to give us enough money so our kids don't have to walk so far. That was the number one issue on her mind when we talked about this morning. So I thought that was interesting. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon, and I would urge your non-support of this particular proposal.
Thank you, Superintendent Reagan. With that, thank you very much for the committee's cooperation today. I know there probably would have been a lot more discussion. This meeting is adjourned.